I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The filmmaker Kagan Go joins me now. His personal film Stolen Memories is having its world television premiere this Sunday, the 4th of March, on Omni Television. I've seen a bit of the documentary already, and it's a fascinating, moving film about this photo album that Mr. Go seeks to return to a Japanese-Canadian family who'd lost it during the internment of the Second World War. The effort he goes through, as well as the people he encounters along the way, helpful and supportive, and not so helpful and not so supportive, is interesting to watch as it reflects and illuminates the cultures involved. Japanese, Japanese-Canadian, Canadian, Chinese, and the history and times, the wartime period of internment, and the confluence of all that in the last 15 years it took to make this movie. The film airs in BC, Alberta, and Ontario on Omni this Sunday at 9 p.m., which is Channel 8 here in Vancouver. If you're in Vancouver, Mr. Go will be hosting a premiere presentation beginning at 7:30 at the W2 Media Cafe at 111 West Hastings, where he'll do a Q&A as well. Admission is by donation. Visit Stolen Memories Movie, that's all one word, .com. For more information, Kagan Go is a filmmaker who studied film at Ryerson. His documentary Mindfuck won several awards. He was born in Singapore and lives here in Vancouver. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Kagan Go. Mr. Go, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. This album, how long ago was it that your brother found it?
He found it, I think, in late 1992, 1993, at a garage sale at a community center, and the man who sold the album to my brother, it actually came with a framed photograph of a Japanese samurai warrior. And the man who sold the album to my brother was Caucasian, and my brother asked him, how did he come across these precious family heirlooms? And he answered indifferently, he found it in his attic collecting dust, and he just wanted to get rid of it. And the album is dated 1939, 3 years before the Japanese internment. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the Japanese were sent to concentration camps, and all their worldly belongings were seized by the Canadian government and sold for a pittance or stolen by looters. So that's how they came to lost this photo album. So I embarked upon a quest to try to find its rightful owners, find out what happened to them, and return the album to them. And I thought it would take me 2 weeks or 2 months. It took me 5 years to find them and 6 years to convince them to be on camera.
So we see that in this movie, you're trying to find the family, and then you find them. In the movie, do we see you trying to convince them?
No, those are negotiations which are done off screen, basically.
Now, in the beginning of the film, there's a scene where a young version of yourself goes to a storage unit.
Mm-hmm.
Was that you who played yourself?
Yes, that was me.
Yeah, and so in reading up on you and reading about this movie, you relate to the internment how?
Well, when I left Singapore, I left for political and economic reasons, and we literally had only 2 weeks to pack, and I was instructed by my family not to tell anybody that we were leaving, not even close friends, so we literally disappeared overnight. And basically, I had only 2 weeks to pack, and I only had one small box of belongings that I could bring with me. And I didn't bring one tactical thing, but all I brought were sentimental treasures like love letters, photographs, postcards, a seashell that I found in a seashore, a pebble that I found in a riverbed, just memorabilia, sentimental treasures that I couldn't part with. And when I found this photo album, I just couldn't understand how anybody could lose such a beautiful photo album, you know. And I felt that the giving back, the desire to give back this photo album was like a symbolic homecoming in terms of returning something to a place of wholeness, completion, and belonging.
So the when you have this album and you want to give it back to whoever you thought it belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
There were no clues. There were no names or anything.
There was only one name, Kay, a first name.
Is that the woman that we see in the...
Yes, it's the woman. That's the owner. Her full name is Kay Kamitakahava.
Yeah. So what do you do when you're trying to find, because this film is also instructive in terms of finding people, and one of the things that this movie is a sort of detective story, mm-hmm. as you and this woman that you meet, Mary Secchi,
yes.
try to find the owners of this album. How do you start?
Well, I actually took the album to Joy Kogawa, the author of Obasan, the Japanese-Canadian author.
Right.
And she suggested that I go to the Japanese-Canadian Citizens Association, where there was a conference on intermarriage. And while I was at the conference, I announced to the audience of Japanese-Canadians there that I wanted to return this photo album that had been lost in the Japanese internment. And in some ways, it was like the call. I had answered the call to the adventure, like this quest. And once I made a public declaration, it was like a promise I made to the Japanese community that I couldn't take back. So that was the beginning of the search. And I literally went from door to door, community to community, showing photo album to Japanese family after family, kind of looking for even the most obscure clues. It was looking for a needle in a haystack.
Did you know that the family was from this part of the world, from Vancouver?
No, I had no idea. I assumed that they once lived in Vancouver, but they could be living in Ontario, which part of the family now is living in Ontario, in Toronto.
The photos that we see in the album, they're taken here, are they, or where are they taken?
They're all taken in Japan.
In Japan.
Yes.
Yeah. So I mentioned Mary Secchi. She's sort of your sidekick in all of this as you try to find the owners of the album. Mm-hmm. How did you guys meet?
Basically, I met her doing my search. She was one of the people that I interviewed. And the very first thing she said to me was, "I feel like I've known you forever." And she literally volunteered to help me in my quest, and she would drive me in a beat-up Nissan pickup truck. And we'd go door-to-door like Jehovah's Witnesses or door-to-door salesmen, mm-hmm. looking for the whereabouts of the owners of the lost photo album. And she was a great detective partner because she used to work for an insurance agency tracking down outstanding debtors. And she was like a Japanese Miss Marple, like from mm-hmm. Agatha Christie.
Yeah, yeah. She was much older than you, right?
Yes, she was in the 70s.
Yeah. What do you think motivated her to want to find these people?
I think a couple of reasons. She really cared about the story, about the family. She wanted, I don't know, her personal reasons. I think partially she also had her own story she wanted me to tell, which I ended up telling in the sequel to Stolen Memories, Breaking the Silence.
Right.
She had suffered from dementia towards the end of her life and had a couple of loops, stories that she kept telling again and again. And stories that obviously were very dear to her. So I think secretly she wanted me to help her tell her story. But I think she genuinely really wanted to help me return the album to its rightful owners.
So you've completed the sequel already. I think I saw a bit of that, the sequel to this movie, right? Stolen Memories?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's about her brother.
Yes.
Her brother who, I guess, after the internment, ended up in jail, right?
Yes. It's about a man named John Akihide Osuji, who's the brother of Mary Seiki, who, during the Japanese internment, Mary Seiki's family was sent to the sugar beet farms in Alberta, basically for slave labor. And after the Japanese internment, the Japanese were given a choice to either repatriate to Japan or move east of the Rockies. They weren't allowed to come back to Vancouver, the West Coast, because of a law called the Dispersal Law, mm-hmm. where they didn't want the Japanese Canadians to reform Japantown or reclaim the farms, the fishing boats, the businesses, the property, the houses. So Mary Seiki's family decided to repatriate to Japan, but Aki, which was the nickname, decided to return to Vancouver, and his family warned him, "Don't go to Vancouver, they'll arrest you, they'll throw you into prison." don't disobey the law. And he said, it's a racist law. It's an unjust law. I'm not going to obey it. It's my right to go back to my hometown. And he returned to Vancouver and was promptly arrested and thrown into Carlisle prison for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
His only crime was being Japanese-Canadian and coming back to the West Coast. And within 24 hours of his release, he was rearrested a second time because the cops wanted to break his spirit.
And so that second movie is his story, and then I guess you're working on the third part of all of this, and that's about Mary, right?
Yes, it's Mary's personal story about being in an arranged marriage and being separated from sort of a true love of her life that she was supposed to marry.
Yeah.
And she never got to marry him.
Mary has since died, right?
Mary has since died. Yes.
Yeah, and she's very in the first part in Stolen Memory. She's rather amusing. You go to a cemetery and she doesn't want her hair to get wet. You're holding an umbrella. Back to Stolen Memories. The family whose album this was, they were hesitant to participate in the movie. Is that a cultural thing, do you think?
I think it's a lot of Japanese Canadians many Japanese Canadians were traumatized by the internment, and they wanted to forget about it, you know, and turn the chapter and move ahead. Oftentimes they weren't very sentimental, which is one of the things that struck me as strange about some members of the family. Some of them weren't sentimental at all, you know. But I think, also, they were concerned about privacy and sort of being shy and not wanting to be in the public eye, you know?
Yeah. Well, when did you know that you had a movie?
Well, it was at the 11th hour when Alan Kamitakahara, the son of the owner of the album, of K. Kamitakahara, he refused to be interviewed until the 11th and three-quarter hour. And he finally agreed to be interviewed, and after the interview, he shook my hand, and he said, "You don't give up, do you?"
And you certainly didn't give up, because I've also read elsewhere that making the movie came at a great personal cost to you, not only financially and the sort, but you suffered through illness throughout it, right?
Yes. I have a bipolar condition, and I was ill throughout the making of the film for the first 10 to 12 years.
And on the website, there, I guess your notes on the movie are there,
mm-hmm.
and you talk about how this illness also gave you the chance to feel sort of what the people you were documenting were feeling about internment, about memories, I guess.
Yes,
right?
Because during my illness, I suffered a great deal of losses. Like, I lost my health, lost my sanity, lost my job, lost my girlfriend, lost a lot of friends, and people sort of walked away from me, you know? And it made me realize that this film or this quest wasn't just about loss and recovery of a photo album, the loss of a photo album 60 years ago and its recovery many years later, or the losses of the Japanese community during the internment, loss of freedom, and the recovery of the community as a whole many years later. But it was also about my own personal losses and recovery. So it made me sort of empathize and become more compassionate to what the Japanese Canadians went through, and it turned from just being a film project to becoming a very personal quest.
And you identify with Japanese culture, do you, in your own life?
Well, I'm Chinese, which is sort of a running joke in the film, because my ancestors were actually persecuted by the Japanese army. Like, 40,000, I'm from Singapore, 40,000 Chinese men were shot in the beaches of Changi, amongst them some of my relatives and ancestors. So the returning of this photo album is almost like a peace treaty between two former enemies. The Japanese and Chinese have been arch enemies throughout history.
I feel like I don't want to give away what happens in the movie, but you do find the owners of this album.
Mm-hmm.
And people can see that on Sunday night, whether they go to W2 or whether they watch it on Channel 8. In terms of finding the family that owned this album, was there anything that you did, say, I mean, the internet, did you use that? What sort of tools did you use?
Well, this was before the time of the internet.
Right.
I guess the internet did exist, but there was very little information. No, I didn't really use internet for research in terms of finding the family.
So the real tools that you used, I guess, were you and Mary going around,
yes,
knocking on people's doors?
Yep.
Yeah. There's something instructive here about history, and there's something instructive in this movie about the internment, about the war experience. What did you want to say about that?
I guess history is a way of repeating itself. If you take a look at what happened after 9/11, there was talk about the possibility of interning, you know, the Muslim community, you know, and I think we have to be wary of allowing history to repeat itself. We should learn from the lessons of the past.
You've finished Stolen Memories now. The second part about Mary's brother, that's finished now too, right?
Well, actually, we're going to be doing a director's cut of Stolen Memories, and we're going to do a longer version of Breaking the Silence, turning it from a half-hour film into an hour-long documentary.
Yeah, and you hope to show that in theaters, do you?
Yes, yeah. In the future.
Yeah. Now that this movie's behind you, do you know yourself better?
Yes, definitely. It's made me a more compassionate and patient person. It also made me realize that I'm a person who doesn't give up, that I'm quite determined and I persevere, but I do it with compassion and patience. It's definitely changed my life. I never thought that this process would take me 15 years, but it's become my life story, you know, in some ways. This quest has been a real adventure for me.
And the stress of it all, the toll it took on your health?
Well, I think the lesson that I learned is that I was putting my career or this film or this quest as being the most important thing in my life. I saw it as a possibility of it redeeming me, you know, clearing my reputation as a filmmaker who had lost this project. But I realized that I had to put my health first. It's kind of like a train. If you have the engine of the train behind the carriages pushing the train forward, it's going to take a lot of stress and a lot of traction and a lot of resistance. But if you put the train first ahead of the rest of the cars and it pulls it along, it's a lot easier. That's the metaphor I would use to sort of putting one's health first. Without my health, I really am no good to anyone, not my friends, not my family, not the community, you know. But once I put my health first, that's the advice I would give people who have suffered or are suffering from a disability and feel that they are unable to do things, you know. Once you make your health your first priority and most important priority, everything else falls into place. Things that once seem impossible suddenly become possible and almost much easier.
So after you complete the trilogy, what's next for you?
I've got a couple of short films that I want to do. One called Disability, based on autobiographical kind of stories about my life, dealing with mental health. And I have a short film called, a feature that I want to do called The Boy Who Faked Kung Fu, about my days in boarding school England, where I basically pretended to know Kung Fu in order to avoid being bullied. So that's sort of like a children's film that I want to do as my first feature.
Yeah, and you live in Vancouver full-time. You intend to work here as well?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, this is Stolen Memories is such a fascinating. It's a good movie. Congratulations on it, Kagan, and I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The movie's world television premiere is this Sunday night at 9 on Omni, which is Channel 8 here in Vancouver. If you're in town and don't want to sit in front of a TV, you can go down to W2 and meet Kagan and see the movie at a presentation there. My understanding is that members of the family will be there as well.
Yes.
Visit StolenMemoriesMovie.com for more information on that. That's Sunday night at 7:30. That all starts, and then I guess they'll watch the movie at 9. The film's writer, producer, and director, Kagan Goh, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantin.